I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of October. The government shutdown is now in day three. One of our guests this hour outlines in Mother Jones some of the agencies and people who are being affected. Just to give you a brief sampling, Kids with Cancer, 30 children who were supposed to be admitted for cancer treatment at the National Institute of Health Clinical Center were put on hold along with 170 adults. People who eat food, 8,000 employees at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention were furloughed, including those tasked with monitoring the outbreak of foodborne illnesses. Domestic violence centers, facilities in Vermont and Montana stopped receiving reimbursement. 85,000 meals no longer being provided to low-income women and their children in Arkansas due to the Agriculture Department stopping funding of the Supplemental Nutrition Program for women and infants and children. And people are going into the mines, but there are no mine inspectors. This hour, we'll talk about the government shutdown and the upcoming debate over the debt ceiling. One of our guests this hour says if the limit isn't raised by October 17, it could create a potential economic disaster. There doesn't seem to be much movement here. The president this morning said that in the next 5 minutes, if Speaker Boehner would pick up the phone and allow a straight vote, then this government shutdown would end, but he won't even let, he said, Obama, the bill get a yes or no vote because he doesn't want to anger the extremists in his party. So what gives here? Who's being affected? And what about the upcoming debt ceiling vote, which could really create substantial problems? Although Speaker Boehner did say, this just happened in the last few minutes, that he will not let the nation default. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our three guests. We'll begin with Professor Kathleen Dolan, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Tim Murphy will also be joining us, a reporter for Mother Jones magazine, and he wrote a piece that outlines 30 ways that the shutdown is already hurting people in this country. Patty Hirsch joining us later this hour, senior producer of Marketplace and author of Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple. Professor Kathleen Dolan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And Tim Murphy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we're into day three. It doesn't look to me, Professor Dolan, what is the political possibility of a breakthrough here? I don't see how anything's going to change.
Well, that's the $64 gazillion question, Kathleen. I mean, both sides seem to be pretty entrenched, and it seems like this is just going to be a waiting game to see how much closer we can get to the debt ceiling default deadline. There doesn't seem to be anything right now that would indicate that either side is willing to cave. I mean, that implies that there is caving to do, but the Democrats seem, you know, very clear and solid behind the position that they will not move, and the Republicans, you know, perhaps will start to think twice or a third time as they get more polling information, as they get more negative impact or a negative reaction from the public. But right now, it looks like everybody's still pretty well entrenched.
Mm-hmm. I was reading the Times this morning, New York Times. One of the letters to the editor, let me put this one at you, Tim, and Professor Dolan, I'd like for you to respond as well. The shutdown of the government presents an odd problem for the news media, Alan writes from Michigan. Usually when a problem occurs in Washington, to be balanced, they say both Republicans and Democrats are at fault. What happens when the blame is asymmetrical? Many people are saying both sides are guilty, but nothing could be further from the truth. House Republicans knew that repealing or delaying the Affordable Care Act would never pass, and thus they created the problem. It seems to me as though House Republicans are starting to feel that in a way. Can we place blame here? Is there, and does it help to place blame here?
Well, I think it'd be difficult to, you know, place the blame for all, you know, problems in Washington, D.C. on one particular group. But this is kind of the rare government budget shutdown in which the fight is not actually over the budget. So in this case, Democrats and Republicans have sort of, you know, found some sort of common ground. It's not really middle ground. Democrats have agreed that the Republican budget proposal is okay. And, you know, the essentially extending the cuts imposed under sequestration is something that, you know, they can live with. So they're not fighting over that. They're fighting over whether or not to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is something that was obviously passed you know, through a democratic process, and most of the people who voted for that, and you know, the president himself, were reelected. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. So this really is, you know, not, you know, a matter of them not compromising. It's really just a matter of Republicans tacking on this fairly extreme demand on top of that.
So the Republicans, it seems to me, would have to give for this to change, because Professor Dolan, there's no way the president is going to say, okay, we agree with you, let's make changes to the Affordable Care Act before it's even gone into implementation. So don't the Republicans have to drop that?
Well, the problem here, I think, is that the focus is not on the right issue. The focus of President Obama did say yesterday that if Republicans have issue with different elements of the Affordable Care Act, there is a process in the Constitution that allows them to submit legislation to make those changes, and they can work their way through the Congress. If simply knowing that those changes wouldn't be implemented because of the existence of the Democratic Senate doesn't mean that we then find some sort of extra constitutional process. So from my perspective as a political scientist, the false equivalency that we're seeing in a lot of media reports here, where people want to focus on this notion, can they compromise
right.
on the budget, that's really the wrong focus. The focus of this, as I've been telling my students, is that, you know, as your guest said, we have adjudicated this question of the Affordable Care Act in many times in the democratic process. If an outcome does not please a particular party, that party can work to elect more of its members. That party can work to lobby people inside the Congress to perhaps make changes, but that you don't hold hostage, you know, some other form of government action. So for me, I think to have the public look at this and say, oh, they just can't agree, is the wrong way to think about it. And I will say, you know, without extensive media bashing, there has been a lot of false equivalence in wanting, it seems somehow, for, you know, on the media's part, to say this is about compromise and the two sides are entrenched. I mean, what we have here is a major political party asking for an extra constitutional process to give them something they want.
Mm-hmm.
We have never faced this before in any realistic way. But we are also not calling it what it is.
Mm-hmm. And what about what the president said concerning the Speaker of the House, John Boehner? Just a little bit of understanding here why it is that the some are calling them extremists, some are calling them hardline conservatives in his party. The president said that he won't let the bill get a yes or no vote because he doesn't want to anger those very people. They seem to have an inordinate amount of power right now. Why isn't there some compromise with those elements?
Called the Hastert rule, which, you know, as the thinking goes, it means that unless a majority of the majority party supports a measure, it's not going to come up for a vote. So the deal is that there are enough votes in the House right now to pass what they call the clean resolution
mm-hmm.
that the Senate would then approve, and there just aren't enough, you know, there's not a majority of Republicans who would vote for that. Denny Hastert, the former Speaker of the House, which that's named, came out yesterday and said he's never heard of the Hastert rule, and it certainly doesn't think it should apply. So there really is nothing technically holding John Boehner back from doing that. It's just a simple matter of if he did that, he would probably lose his speakership.
Except that we don't know that for sure, right? I mean, we can argue that this is about his speakership, and it probably well is. The problem is that by placating this group of people who want a particular outcome, he perhaps, but we certainly don't have a sense of how big this group of Republicans is and how many people would indeed, you know, vote to remove him from the speakership if that were the case. But it is the case that Speaker Boehner could allow a vote, has the power to allow a vote on a bill that would pass to end all of this. He is being responsive to a relatively small percentage of people in his caucus, but it is really unclear how big that group of people is.
Mm-hmm.
But it is clear they are powerful right now.
Let's talk about what's happening as a result of the government shutdown. You, and thank you for doing this, Tim, wrote a fairly extensive list of 48 ways that the government shutdown is hurting people in this country. We hear, well, they're non-essential services. Nobody will notice if they're not around. But some of these are pretty important services. Some would argue that most of them are. But some of them are really crucial to people's health.
Yeah, you know, and to just give one example, you know, the Washington Post reported today that by the end of the week, 5,000 kids will have lost access to Head Start. In their communities, and those are really clustered. So that's 1,000 kids in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's 800 kids in Calhoun County, Alabama. And that's all on top of what we've seen over the last 7 months already with the effects of sequestration, which, by the way, would be enshrined, you know, for the next 5 months
right.
if continuing resolution is passed. There's a lot of things. The Center for Disease Control has to furlough a lot of people, and they've said they're not going to be able to properly monitor their flu vaccination program, and they're not going to be able to properly pay attention to outbreaks, whether that's in the United States or abroad.
Which is something that people monitor pretty closely, and it starts pretty soon, the flu season, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, even if you're not, you know, a government employee or a government contractor, you don't even know anyone who's a government employee aside from your mailman. That's something, flu vaccinations are something that does affect you, regardless of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that people are concerned about those the effects of the shutdown? Professor Dolan?
I think that they are. I think that the sorts of items you just mentioned are a good way for people to sort of perhaps emotionally attach to what's happening. I know when I asked my students yesterday, you know, there are all sorts of different ways in which, you know, people in their everyday lives have been affected by this. But just one other point that I think we could make and opens up a whole different argument is the notion that we are continuing to lurch from continuing resolution to continuing resolution, because it's been about 3 years now since the appropriations process for funding the federal government has worked in the way that it had usually worked and is supposed to work, and that it is the sort of inability of the two parties to come to some permanent agreement on all of these things that causes all of these crisis points. If we got a clean resolution today and it went for 5 months, we'd be looking at the same problem in five
right.
months. We got to the CR that put us past the election because they said, well, let's wait till after the election and we'll fight it out. We're in the very same place. We'll be in this place 5 months from now. We'll be in this place 2 years from now if nothing changes.
Well, what has to change? You can't have a country operating this way. A lot of people are saying that. If you have a government providing services and people are counting on them for their health and for their safety, you've got to have people work together to move everything forward. What in the world is going to happen to make moving forward a possibility?
Well, you know, the short of it is how we've always done it, which is elections. But obviously we've kind of come to contradictory, you know, conclusions in our last couple of elections. In 2010, you had this landslide of conservatives and, you know, roughly 73, you know, pickup in the House of mostly, you know, Tea Party Republicans. And then 2 years later, you know, President Obama.
Just about a foreseeable future, Professor Dolan.
Yes. As somebody said yesterday, you know, the success of the sort of Republican Party moving forward was not necessarily the gains they made in 2010 themselves, but the process of redistricting the House of Representatives that allowed those gains to be made. We won't redistrict again until after 2020. And so if it is unlikely that, you know, very safe Republican districts will change their voting patterns, there may well not be significant shift. I mean, we may have, you know, people are saying now, well, you know, in 2014, maybe the Democrats have, you know, pick up some seats. They're not going to pick up, you know, the tidal wave that might be necessary to shift these sorts of things. So it is no way to run a country, except we've been doing it for the last 3 years, and we may limp along like this into the future.
We welcome phone calls. Here is our phone number. What are your thoughts as we enter day number three of the government shutdown? Tim has written, we'll put this on our Facebook page, 48 ways a government shutdown will hurt people, agencies, and people who are sick, people who work in the mines. There's no mine safety, people who are investigating accidents. There are significant ramifications of such a government shutdown affecting real people's lives and safety and health. Is it important to you? What in the world are we going to do as a country to have this country operate, to have government operate? What's the solution here? Here's our phone number, 800-486 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our guest this part of the show, Tim Murphy, a reporter for Mother Jones, and Professor Kathleen Dolan, who is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Our lines and our pages are open to you, so we will go to your phone calls and comments in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second half hour of this hour, if the shutdown persists, it could become entangled with an even more consequential battle over the debt limit. We'll be talking with Patty Hirsch, who is a senior producer for Marketplace, about that, the second part of the show. And later today on Central Time at 4 o'clock, a journalist says the media is doing a disservice to Americans by not holding politicians accountable over the government shutdown. He says when journalism fails, so does our democracy. Let's go to phone calls. Lines are filled here. Tom in Wauwatosa, you start us off. Hi, Tom.
Hi, yeah. I was just wondering, you know, you touched on the question of gerrymandering in the last segment, and I wonder if this isn't the real issue that we should be talking about, since so many of the moments of intransigence seem to come from, you know, entrenched extreme positions on both sides.
Professor Dolan?
Well, you know, gerrymandering is a complex and sort of challenging topic because we have gerrymandered districts as long as we have been a nation, and we've done it for different reasons. You know, you can gerrymander in a way that protects incumbents who hold a particular office. You can gerrymander to protect people of a political party. You know, we have had experiments with what we call racial gerrymandering to create districts that can allow for more diversity in our representation. So gerrymandering in and of itself, it has a pejorative sense, but it's not necessarily always a negative concept. It is, as with all things, you know, the devil's in the details. How do we carry it out? We allow these decisions to be made at state levels in the United States. There are some states that have tried to remove the partisan elements of it by having nonpartisan commissions do their redistricting or judicial panels do the redistricting. But in the vast majority of states, it's still a partisan activity that's controlled by state legislatures. And so that is, you know, in large part what gets us to the place where we are now.
Thank you very much, Tom, for the call. Let me ask you if either of you know if we have any historical precedent for what's happening here. You have a health care battle that went on for years in this country. You had the Affordable Care Act finally pass, maybe not a lot of Republican support, but it passed as things do. You had it supported by the constitutionality by the U.S. Supreme Court. It goes into effect on Tuesday of this week. And then you've got a part of government holding up a budget because of a bill that they think is disastrous and that they don't want to have go into effect. They want it to have it changed. Has anything like that, obviously people are going to disagree about some substantial big changes in government, but has it ever been before been tied to a budget?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously the bar for dysfunction was set very high by Southern Democrats in the 1860s. But, you know, as far as the specific, you know, instance that, you know, that we're looking at right here in which, you know, we are talking about repealing a law in order to go forward with the functioning of the federal government, I can't think of anything. Certainly the 1995-1996 shutdown that everybody kind of looks to, you know, for the recent example, wasn't like that. That was based on the budget. You know, the shutdowns of the 1980s were, you know, largely based on, you know, how much money to spend on things.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, the federal government largely functioned. So this is at least kind of without modern historical precedent.
Mm-hmm. You agree with that, Professor Dolan?
Yes, I can't think of a thing that matches this. This really does rise, as Tim said, to just a completely different level of sort of dysfunction and inability to use the system we have.
Yeah. Steve in Chippewa Falls. Hi. Hi, Steve. Are you there, Steve? Steve is not there. Let's go to Joe in Stevens Point. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. Hi. I just wanted to talk about, or at least mention, and I think the previous caller did this too, mention apportionment between the states and the House of Representatives. And I think your guest noted how difficult that it really is, because essentially what you would need to do is create a national law to to regulate the states to essentially regulate their the way that they apportion out their congressional districts. And, you know, that has a lot of constitutional pitfalls, because there's nothing in our Constitution that specifically says, hey, the federal government can actually regulate these elections. And that becomes problematic. At the same time, what other solution do we really have? There has to be some national consensus. I mean, you could talk about the influences that go into those gerrymandered districts and whatever, but, you know, there's a couple really big pitfalls in the way we do our democracy here. I mean, I can mention several others, but I won't. I think that's something that, like, as a nation, we should really start thinking about. And then it's difficult, too, because you have people as part of their home districts love their representative but hate Congress. And that really gets us nowhere, because the whole system needs to change no matter who your representative is.
Who wants to respond?
Well, you know, the caller raises some important points. I mean, it would be next to impossible and really not appropriate under our system of federalism for, you know, some sort of national process for redistricting. I mean, one thing that many people don't realize is that much of what happens in elections and federal elections in the United States is actually controlled by states. So whether there could be, if you valued this, whether there could be a move state by state by state to try to bring more nonpartisan decision-making to redistricting practices, that is a possibility for reform. It is almost assuredly not a possibility for that sort of thing to be imposed, you know, from Congress on down. I don't think we could ask this Congress to entertain anything like that to begin with, but it really wouldn't be appropriate. Elections exist as functions for people to elect the people back in their state legislatures who undertake these powers. So, you know, again, as Tim says, we have systems that can function. People have to be informed. They have to pay attention. But they have to want a certain thing. And there may well be people who believe that their own, you know, political interests are served by the system the way it is.
Thank you, Joe, for the call. David in Minneapolis. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, David. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
All right. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm a little confused. I've got a couple of points to make, if I could. The first one would be, I believe our government has shut down about 12 times in the last couple of decades, if I'm not mistaken on that. I think the last time was in the 90s under President Clinton's administration. But I was just wondering, what's the longest it's been shut down, and what were the consequences at that time? And also, you know, maybe we can do something to change our attitude and our point of view on government control of our health system. I'll hang up and let you comment. Thank
All right.
You.
Thank you, David.
Sure. Well, the caller's right, the most recent shutdown was 1995 to 1996. And that was actually two separate shutdowns for a total of 28 days. The shutdowns in the 1980s, of which there were, certainly a bunch, didn't last very long, and they weren't kind of as far-reaching. I think they were a little bit more limited in their scope. In 1995 and 96, that ultimately cost about $2 billion in lost, economic activity. And, you know, sort of in addition to most of the stories that you hear now, so delayed gun processing permits, lost tourism revenue, closed monuments, slow paperwork, stuff like that, it also ended up costing Republicans at the ballot box.
Professor Dolan, what would happen if you had 1 million people, or maybe 2 million people, march on Washington this weekend and say, that's it, we've had it?
Well, that would get some nice media coverage.
Yes, it would.
It might provide, you know, some greater pressure to, you know, the Republicans who could control this process by allowing a bill to go forward. But, you know, substantively, it wouldn't do that much. I mean, one of the things that we often forget is that the vast majority of the American, you know, the vast majority of people are not tuned in to this. They don't know necessarily what's going on. They don't understand it. And it doesn't, you know, really rise to the level of something people care passionately about to be able to exert pressure beyond the million people who might show up in your Washington. So one of the things that we have to grapple with is that we have the system we do in part because Americans, you know, day in and day out, aren't focused on these sorts of things.
Thank you both very much for being with us. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Professor Dolan.
Sure.
Thank you.
Professor Kathleen Dolan is professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and Tim Murphy is a reporter for Mother Jones. We'll put his list of various agencies that are not working and people who are being affected by this government shutdown on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest, the next part of the show, says there's greater concern about the debt ceiling now. If the limit isn't raised by October 17, it could create a potential economic disaster. So that next debate is just a couple weeks away. And our guest is Patty Hirsch, senior producer for Marketplace and author of Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. Hello, Patty. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
So we're having a huge debate right now. Do you think that this will continue in the next couple of weeks, that we'll have another debate like this? Will they allow us to not meet our obligation?
Well, we're definitely going to have a debate. There's no doubt that this is another whip that the Republicans can crack. It's another stick with which they can beat the Obama administration. So there's absolutely no doubt that we're going to be talking about the raising the debt ceiling and a possible default, and it could go right up to the wire.
And what would be the consequences of that, Patty?
Well, the consequences of going to the... Well, there's two things. There's the consequences of going up to the wire, and then there's the consequences of actually defaulting. So let's talk about going to the wire first. There's a lot of talk about the fact that people are looking at the United States right now and saying, you know, how reliable is this country? You know, we lend the United States a great deal of money. I mean, we have an enormous national debt, $16 trillion.
Ooh.
That's money that's lent to us by people all around the world. And of course, they're only lending to us on the proviso that they're firstly going to get paid the interest payments that we owe, and secondly, that they're going to get their money back.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a Congress that's unable to make decisions about spending and unable to make decisions about raising its spending limit or its borrowing limit, then those people who are lending us all that money might say to themselves, well, maybe we shouldn't be lending these people any money anymore. And, you know, it really doesn't help us when we actually try to go out, and we go out every week to try and borrow from people. It doesn't help us when we're actually out there with the cap trying to actually to borrow down the line. So that's the first problem, is the debate that takes us up to the wire.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's not doing as good in terms of our profile in the world, if you like.
And you say that we think of our debt as owed to foreign countries, and I want to talk more about those foreign countries in a moment. But you remind us that America owes a lot of money to sources closer to home, namely ourselves. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, the vast majority of the money that we owe actually is owed to Americans. So we owe about between five and $6 trillion to foreign organizations and countries. But $10 million of the money that we owe, $10 trillion of the money we owe, is owed to ourselves. That's either to large government programs like Social Security is a particularly big lender to the American government, or to individual investors, and pension funds, and even the Federal Reserve, of course, which lends money to the Treasury. So, you know, really, we're kind of borrowing from ourselves and also lending to ourselves. So, actually, the biggest threat to people not paying their money back is, or to our economy by people not paying their money back, is ourselves.
Hmm. So you mean that there's a threat to retirement accounts, to Social Security, to all of that if we don't raise the debt limit?
Absolutely.
Really?
If you don't, well, yeah, of course, because if we don't raise our debt limit, if we can't borrow any more money, okay, it means that we're then not able to pay some of our, we hear about paying our bills. Well, the biggest bill that we have to pay, the most important bill, are the interest payments on the debt that we've already borrowed. Right. So all we have to do is fail to make one interest payment. And people around the world are going to say, hang on a second, these guys are not making their interest payments. And okay, so maybe those people are borrowing the 10-year bond as opposed to the 3-month treasury note. They may say to themselves, or the bill rather, they may say to themselves, well, if these guys aren't able to make an interest payment on this, maybe they won't make an interest payment on my bond. So what should I do? I should sell my bond.
Mm.
And suddenly you've got a lot of people selling their government, their U.S. government bonds. And when selling pressure like that happens in the market, the price of those bonds falls.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does, two things. First of all, it actually does three things. First thing it does is it reduces the value of people's portfolios. So that will include Social Security. So Social Security, say, is, you know, however many billions of dollars. When the value of those notes falls, of those government bonds falls, the value of the Social Security portfolio will also fall. The second thing that it does is it actually increases selling pressure on people who have sort of companies and institutions that have portfolios, because when they hit a certain limit, they're required to sell. So suddenly those people are going to have to start selling. Suddenly you've got even more selling pressure on the market. And what does that do? Because it lowers the price of those bonds. It means that we then have much more difficulty going out and borrowing new money in order to refinance those bonds in the first place. In other words, our borrowing costs then go up. And suddenly we're in this horrifying spiral where our cost of borrowing is going up and our ability to borrow is going down.
Wow, what you're saying is pretty darn scary, Patty.
It's very frightening. And that's why a lot of people are making a big deal about this. I mean, the government shutdown is one thing. Yes, it's unpleasant and, you know, people are not going to get paid for a while and it's going to cost us a lot of money. That's a problem. Absolutely. But our failure to make good on our interest payments to people who we've lent or borrowed money from, is a huge problem, potentially catastrophic for not just our economy, but the global financial system.
Mm-hmm. There was a report in the New York Times just a little while ago, and it goes like this: with a budget deal still elusive and a deadline approaching on raising this debt ceiling, Speaker John Boehner has told colleagues that he is determined to prevent a federal default and is willing to pass a measure through a combination of Republican and Democratic votes, according to one House Republican. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's right now it's just talk. I mean, I don't know much about the way John Boehner does business, but it seems to me pretty clear that he has real problems controlling parts of his caucus. And I think that, you know, unless he can whip those people into line, those Tea Party Republicans who are being particularly independent of the party as a whole, he's going to have a problem getting that kind of consensus together.
We welcome phone calls for Patty. The next debate, of course, and we're into it really already, is raising the debt ceiling. And you've heard Patty explain, which is pretty frightening, isn't it, the consequences of our defaulting here. Patty is a senior producer at Marketplace and the creator and host of Marketplace Whiteboard. And he is the author of Man versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. For you to join this conversation, phone number is the same, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about the debt ceiling. And that debate that's coming up, is it also going to be tied to health care? What kind of debate are we going to see on this, or will it be smoother sailing? What does the debate over the government shutdown tell us about the way the debate about the debt ceiling is going to take place? We welcome your phone calls. We'll start taking those in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The debt ceiling this hour, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you, and we start with John in Magnolia. Hi, John.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening all hour, and yeah, I'm just one of those Americans who feels like he's getting squeezed from both sides. I understand not paying our bills, but I understand that, you know, my wage isn't going up as fast as inflation, and I'm not worried about investing in bonds. I'm worried about putting food on the table. And this current financial policy of just stimulus, spend, throw money at the problem, it's having the wages and the gap that public radio talks about between the middle class and the 1% getting wider. And no one's addressing that. Yeah, we can raise the debt ceiling till kingdom come, but it's not going to solve the problems for many Americans that have been spiraling out of control for decades. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Spending is the problem. We're overspending. What do you think, Patty?
Well, I understand exactly what John is saying, and in many ways he's right. But, you know, we're just recovering from a financial crisis that nearly destroyed the entire global economic system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, it's almost like the sinking ship is going down and we're worried about rearranging the chairs, you know, up on the sun deck. You know, you've got to patch that hole first. You've got to get the ship actually sailing again before you can actually start to pay attention to the details. And I hate to talk about American workers being the details, but the fact is that the American economy is still struggling. And the government, rightly or wrongly, and the Federal Reserve, believe that the only way to get the ship upright again is to do this, is to have this spending program and to pump money into the economy in the way that it's doing. And now, I can understand that, you know, people hear about all of this bond print, this money printing through this bond buying program that the Federal Reserve has, and they're wondering where all that money is. And they say, well, it's all in the banks there, so the banks seem really, really safe. What about the rest of us? But the fact is that we've constructed this system in a way that unless the banks are safe, then the rest of us are not safe. So we've got to get that financial system sorted before we can actually turn to, actually making sure that more people are employed and that we've got money going around the system in a more equitable way.
Eric in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, is there any legal mechanism at all for the president to raise the debt ceiling himself? Can he issue some decree that says, regardless of what Congress says, this is the debt ceiling now?
Apparently there is, Eric. Yeah, I mean, apparently you may have heard this thing about the silver coin. You know, he can actually, because the president has the Treasury has the power to actually to print money that's or currency that can have, you know, really any value. Apparently, they can actually print this coin that could actually deal with this problem almost by sleight of hand.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that much about it, to be honest. But if you want to get on the old Google there and have a look around, you can probably find quite a few stories about this. I was reading about it the other day. It didn't make that much sense to me, but apparently, it is legally possible for him to do it. It's probably not that advisable because it's extraordinarily inflationary, and I think it would probably cause him more problems politically than it would solve.
He's already got a lot of problems. How many
more problems. Yeah.
Can you have, for heaven's sake? Thanks, Eric, very much for the call. Ronaldo in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, ma'am. My question is, with the job numbers that come out every month, 160,000 support, and I think I estimate 70% of those were part-time jobs, why does the press continue to keep saying that the economy is getting better? I don't understand that. And why is it the president having an answer for that?
That's a really great question. And I think it has to do with the difference between unemployment and GDP. All right. So if you want to take, you can take any measure of improvement in the economy that you want. If you want to say, oh, well, it really should be all about employment, then depending on which number you take in employment, you could say things are getting better. It's like, oh, we can look at the employment numbers. It used to be 9% unemployment. It's now 7% unemployment. And you can trumpet those numbers. Of course, it doesn't take into account, as you say, the fact that a lot of those jobs are part-time. The fact that one of the reasons that the unemployment number is going down is because a lot of people have dropped off the rolls completely because they're not looking for work anymore. So, you know, these numbers are twistable and squeezable and malleable and massageable in all sorts of ways. But a lot of people will ignore those numbers altogether. Well, not ignore them, but they'll say, okay, yes, we can see unemployment's here, but what's really making us happy is gross domestic product. So they'll actually focus on another number completely. And if GDP is doing well because a couple of industries are doing well, then you can sort of flag that and say that we're doing very nicely. The fact is, I think, that the economy is bumping along. It's like it's hit the bottom and it's bouncing along like a baseball, you know, as it sort of trickles towards the line there. It's not really hiking up in the way that anybody would want it to. If it was, we'd be seeing the end of this quantitative easing program that the Federal Reserve has. And they've decided not to settle down on that for now because they believe that the unemployment numbers have to get a lot better before they do that. And the economy needs to show some real signs of growth. So, I mean, I think, Ronaldo, that you're on the money there, that the unemployment numbers are not a good gauge necessarily of the state of the economy at this point. And I think the Federal Reserve's actions recently and its remarks and its latest meeting are proof of that.
Do you think members of our government, particularly House Republicans who have fashioned and are carrying out a government shutdown, really, it's really the work of some people in the House. Does this give you any indication at all of how the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling is going to be handled politically in Washington, or do you think they will be two entirely different deliberations?
A good question. You know, I think before we actually hit the shutdown, there was a lot of talk at this was sort of the end of last week that, you know, the Republicans basically had two cards to play. They could make a fuss over the shutdown or they could make a fuss over the debt ceiling. And this theory, I'm not sure that I agree with this, but this theory was that, you know, if they made a big hoo-ha over the shutdown, which, you know, really would do some harm to the economy potentially, but not as much harm as the debt ceiling, raising a fight over the debt ceiling and default would cause. So they were able to make a big hoo-ha over this. And then when it comes to default, they'll push it to the wire, but actually let it go through as they always have done in the past. That said, you know, the small number of very, very conservative, you want to call them Tea Party Republicans, have been so vociferous about this and dug in their heels so deeply that whilst the majority of Republicans, I think, would have those cooler heads that would not want the United States to default, mm-hmm. to default, these people may dig their heels into the point that they make life so difficult for John Boehner and the Republican leadership that they actually do tip us over the edge. I mean, you know, history has shown that many, many times we've been plunged into horrors of war. I mean, the First World War is a great example. Plunged into the horror of war simply because of brinkmanship. Nobody wanted to go to war, mm-hmm. but because everybody pushed everybody in the wrong direction, we sort of all fell over the edge by mistake in a way. And I think that there is a real danger that if we see these Republicans dig their heels in this way, that we could actually go over the edge this time.
Mm. John in Brilliant. Hi.
Hey, Kathleen. Hi, Patty.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
You were discussing the fact that a lot of our big issue is that we have to cover the interest costs on the money that we've already borrowed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to borrow money to pay that interest. Well, where do we find the money to pay the interest on the money that we borrowed to pay the interest?
Well, we're in this great situation right now where everybody believes that the United States is a great credit risk. So it's kind of like having a credit card, you know, which has a revolving capacity, which like just sort of it rolls over every year. But that credit card will only roll over if your bank agrees to let it roll over. So we're really going to the same people again and again and again to borrow. And they're like, oh, yeah, I've been lending you to you for this last year and a half. I'm prepared to let it go for another year. I'm prepared to let it go for another year. But as soon as we start to run into problems with our ability to pay, even just our interest, not let alone our ability to pay back the principal, as soon as we run into that issue, they might say, you know what, we're not going to roll this debt over anymore. That's the kind of technical term for it. We're not going to let you roll this over. We're going to stop lending money to you. And suddenly we're like, oh, no, how are we going to get this money? And what we'd have to do is we'd have to go to the same people or maybe a whole different constituency of lenders and say, look, let us pay you more. Instead of like, you know, 3% on this, we'll pay you 6% or 9%, whatever it takes. And suddenly you start to see those borrowing costs go up because you're going to a whole new constituency of lenders.
And from those foreign countries, is it mostly China or are there many?
No, there are many, many, many. I mean, the biggest lenders to us are China and Japan. I think it's sort of $1.6 and $1.3 trillion respectively. But, you know, and in some cases, it's just the country. Like in China's case, I believe the vast majority of that is just the Chinese government. Whereas in the case of Japan, it's both the Japanese government and Japanese individual borrowers and institutions as well. And the same goes through, you know, all sorts of countries, you know, the British, the Irish, the Germans, you know, you name it. They're all mm-hmm. they're all lending money to us. And the reason they lend money to the US is because we're a very, very good credit risk. You're going to get your money back. You're going to get a little bit of a return. Not too much because, you know, we don't want to pay too much, but you're going to get a little bit of return and your money is safe. And so if you want to put your money in somewhere safe, you can either put it in a bank or you can lend it to the U.S. government. Hmm. That's the status of our lending quality or borrowing quality right now. And we are risking that reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day we push ourselves towards the brink of default and not raising the debt ceiling.
We would really be upsetting the economy of the world, wouldn't we?
If we went over the edge, we absolutely would be, yes.
John, thank you for your call. Some lines are open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Jason in Appleton is next. Hi, Jason.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, I've always debated with some of my Republican friends about, you know, this recent rash of debt hawks that have come out and the talk of debt ceiling. And I just want to remind everyone that just a few years ago, during the 8 years of Bush, we raised that debt ceiling 7 times. He allowed that debt ceiling to be raised. If I remember right, 7 times. And I pay attention to a fair amount of news and read a lot of news. And during those 7 times during the Bush administration, I don't remember even hearing the term debt ceiling. And if it was, it was nowhere like now. So he borrowed a ton of money and all that stuff, just like they're saying Obama is doing. And why was it never brought up in all those times during the Bush administration?
Well, it's absolutely true that, you know, George W. Bush borrowed a great deal of money when he was president. But I think that, to be fair, the people in the you didn't hear much from the Republican Party back then because you didn't really have Tea Party Republicans in those seats back then. And it's that kind of groundswell of very conservative Republicans that have been elected to the House since. And they're very upset about this. They're very upset about the fact that we borrow too much. And, you know, they have a point. I mean, we're being very, you know, on the face of it, very fiscally imprudent by borrowing so much, because the more you borrow, the more risk you have that you may not be able to pay it back. So, you know, I can see their point. But the fact is that, you know, when it comes to government spending, it's a Democratic and Republican issue. It's like two people are sitting down and deciding, oh, we're going to go to dinner 7 nights a week, but we're only going to pay for we're going to use our credit card 6 nights. And you get to the table and, you know, they call over their assistant, who's the Treasury, and they say, use your credit card or pay for this dinner, but you can't use your credit card. And he's like, well, what am I supposed to pay this with? You guys have already eaten the meal. You want me to pay for it, but you won't allow me to use my credit card. And we don't have any cash. So this is really an issue with Republicans and Democrats together in Congress making decisions to spend and therefore to borrow in order to do that spending, and then restricting the Treasury's ability to pay for it. And it's completely self-imposed. Congress has already agreed to the spending. It's just not agreeing to the use of the credit card. And, you know, there's no limit to our ability to borrow. The only limit is people's lack of willingness to lend to us. And that doesn't seem to be any lack of willingness to lend to the American government at this point. It's cheaper than it's ever been.
Thanks,
so
Jason.
It's an entirely self-imposed restriction.
For the call, this is John in Door County. Would not the elimination of the Federal Reserve note to be replaced by U.S. Treasury notes immediately eliminate the present 2% interest that the U.S. government pays to the Fed, an interest for money that it borrows from the Fed to operate?
Wow. You know, the Federal Reserve doesn't lend that much money to the government. It's not really that much. It's a couple of trillion. I mean, it's a fair amount of money, but it's in the range of what the Chinese lends. So I actually don't think it's that significant, as significant as some people make it out to be. You know, the real lenders, as I say, are Social Security, the other big entitlement programs, and the American people themselves. And you know, obviously the Treasury or the Federal Reserve is part of that, but a relatively small part.
Rick in Fond du Lac, hi.
Good afternoon. I just have a macroeconomic kind of comment and then would like some feedback. I've talked about this before on shows with you, Joy. I think we live in a new norm now with the gross domestic product where it's at. And when the United States is the majority of the revenues driven in this country are from a consumption basis, the only way that we're going to continue to see up growth because we are such a consumption-based country is eliminating the IRS and go to a consumption-based tax so people have discretionary income to spend money as a mass macroeconomic driver. Until we do that, we're going to continue this kind of new norm within our GDP that cannot continue to, you know, support the amount of spending we have. There has to be a shift in the, you know, our system as far as going to a consumption tax.
Okay. What do you think, Patty?
Well, I don't necessarily disagree. I mean, there's a lot of people have talked about having a consumption tax, and it's an interesting model. I mean, I've lived in countries around the world where they have, you know, very high consumption taxes, places like Singapore, which get a lot of their revenue from consumption. So I can see the point. But of course, it's not necessarily the case that the wealthy people who earn a lot of money actually consume a lot as well. So if you're interested in sort of redistribution of income to make it fairer, then, you know, that may not necessarily work. I mean, say you have a relatively poor family that has 7 kids. They may be consuming a heck of a lot more than a wealthy family that has no children, right? So, you know, maybe you're not going to get that sort of redistribution of income that taxing in that type of way would hope to achieve. So I think it's a model. It's certainly worth looking at, and I'm sure people do look at it. But I'm not sure it's the cure-all that a lot of people believe it is.
Thanks, Rick, for the call. And rather than ask another economic question, let me just ask, because you have a beautiful way of speaking, where are you from? Where have you lived, Patty?
Well, I've been lucky enough to live all around the world, but I'm originally from Northern Ireland, just outside Belfast.
Oh, you are? Uh-huh. Oh, that's. I was trying to pinpoint what part of Ireland, but I couldn't. It sounds
it's
like
difficult.
You have influences from all over the world as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my family's a marriage of the orange and the green. You know, my dad's from the north and my mother's from the south.
Uh-huh.
Needless to say, they're not married anymore. But since then, I've lived all over the place. I've been in the UK. I've been in Asia. Been in the US for most of the longest amount of time I've lived anywhere is actually in Los Angeles, which really surprised me. I'd never if somebody told me that 10 years ago, I'd have laughed at them.
Right, Patty. Thanks so much. Join us again. You were so informative. I appreciate it,
Kathleen. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Patty Hirsch, senior producer of Marketplace, author of Man vs. Markets: Economies Explained Plain and Simple. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Rest assured, we'll be on this story again next Monday, whatever form it's going to take by next Monday.